Blog Talk Radio.
Big show tonight, and director Michael Winterbottom. Yes, Michael Winterbottom. They'll be talking about their new collaboration titled Trishna in a little bit. I'm Jamie. Let me bring up my co-hosts, Jerry and Dean. Hey, guys.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, how are you?
Dean, seriously, you sound like you're speaking from someone's urethra.
Oh, my God, dude. That's harsh, but hilarious.
It's from your phones.
Wow, okay.
Okay. I guess let's start with a couple of news items. How's that?
I have a news item.
Sure.
Did anybody watch, and I just watched the clip, I think at the Wrap or somewhere online. Did anyone watch Mel Gibson on Jay Leno?
I did. I was going to bring that up, yes.
Okay.
Was that awkward or what?
Well, it was awkward, but I have to say he's very smooth. He spun that in his favor. I mean, that was incredible. I mean, it was like a magic act. He managed to turn, make it, you know, almost make him out to be likable, almost. Like, it was like pre, you know, 2002. I was kind of dumbfounded how smooth he can be.
I thought it was completely awkward and staged. I thought that it was so completely pre-planned.
Oh, it's pre-planned.
There's a reason why he went on Leno, because Leno won't call him on anything.
No,
Letterman
doesn't
Letterman
call
would.
Anybody on anything. I mean,
Letterman would.
Oh, Letterman would, but he was just so. I mean, he was it because it was. I just thought he was very smooth. I was like dumbfounded by how he did pull it off. But here's the thing: have you read the comments section in any of these articles where this has appeared? He has
some.
People behind him. I mean, he has people behind him. Who are willing to go along with him, and it's impressive. I mean, he has a staying power after all this that I'm blown away by. I mean,
yeah.
The box office doesn't show that anymore, but he has a very loyal fan base. But I thought he was very smooth. I was dumbfounded by that. Of course, it's staged. It's Hollywood. I mean, of course, but and he's on Leno. That's just the only place he's going to go on. He ain't going to go on Letterman. He ain't going to go on Stewart. I don't think he'll go on Piers Morgan just because, well, no one on their right mind should go on Piers Morgan because he's a moron. But the British hated him for that matter.
Yeah. See, and I didn't think he came across well at all. So I guess it's just kind of two different perspectives.
Yeah.
Now,
do I think he sounded intelligent? No, but he just sounded like, my God, he spun this. I mean, this is like, this guy should run for all, like, go into politics. I mean, it was very smooth. It was very,
yeah.
I mean, I was just like,
I mean,
he really
said the only thing he could say.
I have a bit of a temper.
So the Avengers open up overseas,
mm-hmm.
and it's done extremely well.
Oh, it's done. It's broken every overseas record, and I'm sure it will break records here next weekend. So,
just under $180 million.
Wow.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
That's great.
This thing's going to be a behemoth. Aaron went and saw it and said it was really good.
Oh, it looks incredible. I mean,
a lot of fun.
One movie I'm really looking forward to.
Yeah, apparently the success of the movie is that it gives equal time to all of these characters. You don't
mm-hmm.
feel gypped by any of them. And they said that the standout, from everything that I understand about it, is Mark Ruffalo's Hulk.
Yeah, I read that too, yeah. Definitely.
He's the best Hulk.
Yeah.
He's an interesting actor.
Yeah,
and he's
great.
Not somebody that I would associate with Hulk necessarily, because
mm-hmm.
he doesn't really, he seems kind of laid back.
Right.
You know. But anyway, what do you think, Dean?
I'm looking forward to the movie, and I think Ruffalo is probably the best actor in the. And I mean, it's a great cast, so I can't say anything bad about anybody in the cast. So, I mean, I'm excited about it, particularly because of Joss Whedon, and I'm still sort of disappointed that Cabin in the Woods didn't do as well as I had hoped. I think it's only at, what, $32 million now, and it's about to drop off the top 10, I think.
Yeah,
so.
It just couldn't find, it just, I don't, you know, we had this talk last week or the week before. I mean, it's just, unfortunately, it's just, it broke the rules so much for people, I think, who like, for the genre, it just, it took them out of it.
It won't
lose money. I don't think the Avengers will do that.
No, I don't think the Avengers will do that at all.
I'm excited about this one. It's rare that a superhero movie excites me, but this one seems really good. So
they're going to do. It was announced at the CinemaCon place that where they showed the footage from two Tom Cruise movies, the One Shot and the Oblivion movie.
Mm-hmm.
One Shot is December. Oblivion is April. And then he's got another movie that he's slated to do after Oblivion. And then they're talking, when will he do Mission Impossible 5? And blah, blah, blah. He'll do Mission Impossible 5, but not until he does Top Gun 2.
Hmm, okay.
So Top Gun 2 is a definite go.
Wow, okay.
Is that the longest time in between a original
and
a sequel?
Godfather? No, it would be. It would be.
Yeah,
because Top Gun is 86.
86 to yeah, so yeah, that would be.
Wow. You know what? And it shows you how women, I'm not going to make a fan of women out there, but it shows you how women and men age differently. Because there was a recent photo with Tom Cruise and Kelly McGillis together. And Tom Cruise actually, he doesn't look like he's aged at all.
Yeah.
Mm, yeah, that's true.
He's had a resolutely easier life than Kelly McGillis has had. You know, women just don't age as well as men, let's face it. I mean, they just don't.
Well, I don't know. Kelly McGillis has had a difficult period in her life. But I'm sure Tom Cruise hasn't.
Well, whatever difficulties he's had, you know, millions of dollars to cushion.
I mean, I think it comes down to money. I don't think it really, I mean, okay.
Well, I mean, Rupert Murdoch, he's not exactly handsome, and he's a billionaire.
Yeah, I mean, but he's also 81 years old, so I mean.
Oh, that's right. He was very much a handsome man 30 years ago. Anyway, so Top Gun 2, what would, you think this is a smart move, first of all?
Well, I mean, if they do it, I would like to see, you know, is it going to be like, I mean, a real-time sequel in that sense, that it would take place today?
He would have to be an instructor, right?
He'd have to be something.
Yeah,
he'd
have to raise up in the ranks, you know, quite a bit. So, are they bringing back Kelly McGillis at all? Or
I have no idea. They're writing the script right now. I don't know if Val Kilmer's going to be in it. Tom Cruise just wants to do another movie with Tony Scott, and he wants to get up in an airplane again.
Oh. So Days of Thunder 2 wasn't really an option then, okay.
No.
Val Kilmer, that's somebody who hasn't aged incredibly well.
No. He just played Mark Twain.
Mm-hmm, that's right, yeah.
In L.A. They're rebooting Poltergeist, and they're courting Sam Raimi to direct.
Well, that would be good. I mean, everything's gonna be rebooted, so I'm not even. But I mean, all right, that would be an interesting. I'd be interested to see his take on it.
Whatever. If he directs it, it'll be better than, you know, to get some hack, of course.
Yeah.
But
do you keep the original score? I mean, do you keep that original theme? It's so kind of iconic.
I think
I would.
Yeah.
I would, definitely. It's too bad. I mean, who are they going to get to play Zelda Rubinstein's role, though, you know?
Yeah.
They get the girl from
Zelda Rubinstein
Orphan. They get the girl from Orphan.
Right. We have a lot of love for the original Poltergeist.
Yeah. Oh, it's
oh, for sure.
Not the sequels of the TV show or anything like that, but certainly the first film, for sure.
Is there any doubt that Spielberg directed it?
No doubt in my mind.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely had his hand in that. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think Toby Hooper's been has shot another movie, like a new movie. So here's a new movie that I'm really looking forward to. It comes out next year. It's a small comedy. John Turturro is writing and directing it.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the plot synopsis. A cash-strapped guy decides to become a gigolo as a way of making some money. With his best friend acting as his pimp, the duo causes a commotion in their Hasidic Jewish community.
Mm-hmm.
So it will be John Turturro playing the gigolo, and his pimp will be played by Woody Allen.
That's
will be the
funny.
Best movie of 2013. I mean,
isn't that just great?
That's really funny. That would be
hilarious. What do we have a title yet, or no title?
Fading Gigolo is the name.
Fading Gigolo. Oh my God, that's awesome. That takes it over Star Trek II and Superman and World War Z, even for that matter, for 2013. That sounds great.
Yes. All right. We'll come back. We'll try to get some more movie news to cover at the flip side of this interview. Frida Pinto and Michael Winterbottom. Frida Pinto, we all know from Slumdog Millionaire. That was her American debut. And actually, since then, she's worked with Woody Allen and Julian Schnabel. So she's been in the company of great directors, and Michael Winterbottom is definitely one of them. Their new movie is called Trishna. And it's actually an adaptation of Thomas Hardy's Tess of the D'Urbervilles, set in India. So it's a different slant on the material.
What time period in India? Is it the present day? I mean, it's a fascinating idea. I love this idea.
Yes, present day. Because there's something with the economics and the industrialization of India, kind of as it is now, kind of reflects was it England at the time of Tess?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah. So that's why they switched it to India.
Wow. Fascinating concept.
So we did a conference phone interview with Frida and Michael to talk about the movie. Let me find the file. Here it is. Here is Frida and Michael. To start out with, I want to know from you both what, it comes from Thomas Hardy's source material, obviously. What about that material spoke to you on an emotional level and made you want to make this film?
Well, I read Thomas Hardy's books when I was a teenager, and I think, like, often things you read when you're that age sort of stay with you, and they kind of, seem close to you. And I'd done a film of his last novel, Judy the Obscure, before, and I was in India and thought, actually, a lot of the things he talks about in his books are kind of happening now in India, because he's talking about kind of people who get sort of caught between the kind of modern world and the old world. People who come from kind of rural, stable communities and are suddenly in a world which is becoming sort of modernized through industrialization and urbanization and education and so on. So it seemed like the world that he was talking about was the kind of world you get in India now.
Yeah, and I guess for me it was just, exploring the complexities of human relationships. I think that was going to be something, different to what I've done before. So I was very interested in doing that on this project.
Tell me about those relationships. It's kind of a doomed romance. What about this particular relationship resonated for you, Frida?
Yeah, exactly the kind of relationship I want to have. No, I think she's very different from me, and her actions are really, the driving force behind her actions are also, her situation, so whether it's a family situation or, her economic situation, or also the fact that she's really in love with this man, but really coming from a different class of society, a much lower class of society, she almost does not know how this relationship could even actually happen and take off, So it's kind of, in her head, she almost doesn't believe that this could happen to her. I believe she truly does love him, you know, and wants to have a relationship with him. And I guess just the fact that she has hope, that resonated with me. You know, the fact that she is, in her own way, persistent about trying to make this work, you know, some one way or the other. Unfortunately, it doesn't work for her.
Well, it's interesting to me, the approach of this film, because I've heard that there wasn't necessarily a formal script, but you guys were working more for me, a treatment. Does that kind of, as an actress and as a director, does that force you to be in the moment?
Yeah, I guess working with Michael, you have to be in the moment. You know, you never know if he's going to catch you unaware. All of a sudden, you're sitting, you know, in a bus, and you think you're just traveling to the next location, but no, wait, you're filming. So you have to constantly be active, and that's amazing, because sometimes on the way to location, or, you know, when you know you're going to shoot the next scene, there are so many things that happen, and you're basically capturing life when you are being that open and flexible to working, you know, every minute of the day, I could say so. But it was great, and I made it kind of very clear that we did have a treatment, which is what helped us as actors, you know, to know that this was our guiding material, and this is how we were going to go ahead.
Well, Michael, does it feel like it with that approach that you're walking a kind of high wire?
In the case of a film like Trish, I think one thing is the relationship between Frieda and Liz, it's not really about what they say to each other. I think it's true of most relationships, but certainly in the case of Jane and Trishna, that, you know, they come from different worlds. The communication, you know, is not about how they express their thoughts and so on. So it kind of, you know, forces you to try and think about, you know, well, how would they be in the moment? How would they, you know, what is the relationship? What's happening? And then in the rest of the kind of film, it's, you know, it's a question of like trying to capture sort of a real situation. You know, I try and work as observationally as possible. So the rest of the film is like trying to take our characters into a real place, whether it's the hotel or the hospital or the family, and not disturb that place and try and capture what that's like. Because it's not, I don't really have a kind of sense like the hotel must be like this, or the hospital must be like this, or the family must be like this. It's a question of, well, what is it like, and how can we capture that in the film? So, but I think, you know, for me, working out a script, or working out a full dialogue script, is kind of more enjoyable as well, because you never just shoot the script. I just finished a film where it had a very long script, and most of the day you're sort of shooting the script. In a way, you're not questioning, is it the right thing to be filming? You know, is this the right way of conveying what you want to convey in the scene? It's just like, that's the dialogue in the script, and you end up, if you're not careful, just, you know, just, okay, well, that's the dialogue, let's just do it. And even if it's not quite working, you're sort of finding ways to make it work, rather than asking yourself, is actually this the right thing to be saying? Maybe they shouldn't be saying that. Maybe you don't need to say anything at all. Maybe there's another way of showing something. It's certainly more enjoyable, because, you know, every day you're kind of thinking about what you can get. You know, can you find something that, you know, you can find enough of moments that day that will sort of, you know, be interesting enough to kind of keep in the film. You don't have that kind of feeling like, okay, I've got four pages to shoot, so how do I shoot it?
Well, another aspect of it, you combine professional actors with non-actors, and I'm wondering if that's a particular challenge, and what you both see as the benefit of that dynamic.
I'm sure it's a challenge for actors, but I mean, from my point of view, director, I like that for now on a lot of films, and I like the idea. You know, in a sense, it's slightly pleasure. I the idea that the actors are having to actually relate to kind of things going on around them, but are not totally controlled. You know, so, you know, same with the family, just as family. You know, that family. There's a family, the dad was the Jeep driver, it's actually his Jeep used in the film, that's their house, they go to the school where, you know, that we go to in the film. And so if you have a kind of real world, and you have to kind of think, well, okay, well, how would Trishna really behave? It's not just, you know, okay, the script says, I do this, it's there's all these, you know, kids running around, and the grandparents are there, and the parents are there, and the uncles are there, and it's like, how would it really be to be Trishna, and how, therefore, how would she behave? I'm sure it gives a lot of hassles to the actors.
You know, it is more challenging to work with non-professional actors, because they don't really understand about, you know, not looking in the camera when there's a particular scene happening and all of that. But to be very honest, it challenges you to be as real as possible. Because I do remember the scene that we were shooting in the field where, you know, I throw up, and I kind of, that's the first sign that, oh, she might be pregnant kind of thing. And Michael wanted me to trick all the other women in the field, and, you know, he didn't warn them that I was going to go to the fight and pretend like I was going to throw up. And I automatically felt this amazing amount of pressure on me to do it as naturalistically as possible so that the women wouldn't burst out laughing on camera. Mm. So I guess it's kind of, it is a challenge, but it's very interesting to play it that way as well. It makes you explore a more real side of you, rather than when you have a script, you know, all the other actors are going to respond a certain way. This one is far more challenging.
And at a very, very banal level, it's one thing like, you know, the doctors, the real doctors, all the work in the hotel, the work in the hotel, that makes it, you know, mean that they have, you know, just been themselves, they're doing what they always do. So, it, you know, it means you don't really have to tell them what to do. But,
yeah.
you know, it's always a bad thing if you tell someone to, tell them not to, what to do. It's obviously horrible because they become very self-conscious.
Yeah.
But if they're just being themselves, then it means your film has more texture to it, it's more accurate. But also, they're doing all the work for you. So I have to wonder, what has he got to say in these situations? He just does what he always does.
Well, and I would think directorially, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is what they normally do. So as a director, your job is to kind of facilitate an environment in which they feel comfortable enough to just behave.
Exactly. Basically, it's a question of being as small as possible and as quiet as possible. And that's how we film. It's on set. There's often only three or four people around the camera. And we don't shout action, we don't shout cut, and we have little radio mics, and we try and keep it as so that we're as discreet as possible. They feel as relaxed as possible.
Yeah, not having action cut, I found myself breathing less on this film because I don't know what it is that about the word action. It just kind of, I don't know, makes you freeze a bit, you know? But
yeah.
It's this pressure that comes on you. But when you know you're continuously acting, and you're acting with people who are not used to hearing words like action and cut, it becomes more of a, this is what I do every day. You know, I wake up in the morning and I milk the cows and I take my, you know, brothers and sisters to school. So it feels more like this is your actual life.
Right. Frida, you've worked with so many tremendous directors. I mean, Danny Boyle and Schnabel and Woody Allen. And I'm wondering, what do you learn something from each of them? And what are the most valuable things you took away from your experience with Michael?
Oh, yeah, I learned that they're all different, and they all have different styles of learning, so you can't really base your next film on your previous director's style of working. And that is what is amazing, because you're constantly growing with every project and learning to be more adjusting to everyone's style of working. I mean, I don't think Danny and Woody would ever work in the same fashion, neither would Julian and Michael. So it's amazing that you learn all these lessons from your previous film, but there's always more to learn. And I guess being with someone as flexible as Michael, who lets you kind of improv and set and explore your own character and take it forward, and at the same time there to guide you in case you're going too far or too little, I think that's great. And gives you confidence, actually, knowing that a director like Michael will trust you with a kind of an improv situation. I think it gives you a lot of confidence for your next film.
It occurs to me that we always talk about our great actors and the idea of our great actors being chameleons. But, Michael, you strike me as a chameleon as a director. I mean, you tackle such different subjects on each film. Is that a conscious choice for you?
Only in the sense that, you know, I'm looking for something interesting to do. When I think, you know, like any director, when you think about, you know, kind of, you know, what you want to do next, you look for something interesting. And most, you know, most films I do, the things that we sort of started from, you know, an idea and developed. So I guess it just seems natural to me that if you say you've been doing a film which is a period drama, then the one thing you don't want to do is another period drama. So it's just a reaction to the last thing you've done, I think, often. It would be hard to find something interesting if it felt like you'd already just made a version of that film. So in that sense, I'm aware that happens. But it's not a sort of policy of this time we must look for this because it's different. It's just a question of you come across something, whether someone suggests it to you, or you come across the idea yourself, and it doesn't really matter why it's interesting. The important thing is it interesting?
Okay, that's Frida Pinto and Michael Winterbottom. Trishna, the film they did together, opens up, actually this is a really advanced interview, it opens up in limited release July 13th. So you've got a while to wait.
Yeah, no, but it's going to be on demand, I think, as well, IFC on demand, so.
Yes, prior to that release, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
and is playing at the Seattle Film Festival next month.
Oh, cool.
He's played at several film festivals so far. Seattle's actually, you know, Seattle's film festival runs like a month.
That's cool. That's great. Now, let me. How many films are in that though? Do you know?
I would imagine quite a lot. It runs from May 17th to June 10th.
Wow.
And they're honoring Sissy Spacek and William Friedkin this year. Hey, I sent a request to William Friedkin last month or something 2 months ago,
mm-hmm.
and they said he's directing an opera now. He's about to premiere his newest opera. So I'll keep you updated. So I'll follow up on that request.
Right. Oh, cool.
Because now apparently he's free. He's being honored in Seattle.
Mm-hmm. No, that's great.
We've never had Friedkin on the show. We've had our Friedkin impersonator on.
Wait, you mean that really wasn't William Friedkin? Great. Now, God, everything's been ruined for me now.
I know. The illusion's over.
Oh, the illusion's over. Damn it.
All right. Let us play. It is now time for... listener mail.
Oh,
where's the theme?
Okay, so be patient. All right. Here's our listener mail. Tommy, 1986, writes to us and says, "Great work on the recent shows. The interviews and discussions have been awesome. I look forward very much to the 80s month. The show ideas you had sounded really cool, in particular the Golden Globus show and Harold Faltermeyer show. I look forward also to the upcoming summer of 1987 series." It's from Tommy, 1986.
All right, thank you, Tommy.
Let me tell you something about that summer of 1987 series. Let me stop this. Let me get serious for a moment.
Do we have some serious music to put
on? No, I'm sorry, man. Everything's silly on our switchboard. Every year we do the looking back at the previous summer 25 years ago, and we have a series of guests on. Now, I had difficulty with my computer system at one time, and it deleted 5 shows that had not yet aired.
Oh, shit.
3 from the Music on Film series where we talked about Amadeus and Grease and
right.
something else. So those shows gone. And 2 1987 shows, the Summer School interview and...
Oh, no.
Something else, one other... Yeah, and the RoboCop interview.
Oh, my God.
Miguel Ferrer. Or is that his name, Miguel Ferrer? Yeah. Miguel Ferrer and Dean Cameron, both gone.
Oh, man.
So that got me depressed. So
I can understand that.
I know. I mean, yeah, I completely understand. I mean,
We might just do our regular Summer of 87 roundtable,
mm-hmm.
and then the rest of the month just do general 80s stuff.
Right, okay, all right, but I'm very sorry. Oh, my God.
Yes. Let's bow our heads in a moment of silence for those lost shows.
Oh, wait, you interviewed Christopher Lee?
No, not the summer of 1937. Okay, another listener email. This is from Bo Earl, our good buddy Bo Earl.
Oh, he's wonderful. He's great.
Says, "I thought the discussion on Wednesday about the future economic viability of cinema was really great and provocative. The outlook does seem bleak if you believe, like I do and you guys seem to, that there's something integral to cinema about being in a public place and having something other than an utterly predictable formulaic experience. The trend towards making the theater experience more and more about technological stimulations and superhero pictures lend a lot of credence to the pessimism Dean expressed and to your suggestion that the notion of an auteur renaissance is a fairy tale. But as a movie fan, I think his point is, we really have no choice but to cling to this fairy tale, however irrational it may seem." I mean, he wrote a lot more, but... he's clearly a guy that's extremely passionate about movies, and we've been corresponding back and forth, and he's made some really, really great points about that whole issue that we're talking about. And Peter Jackson just released another statement saying, "I understand people aren't reacting well to my 48 frames per second footage. I think that's because I didn't put enough footage in."
Oh my God. Okay.
That was his argument. Maybe if I put in more stuff, people wouldn't like. It would convince them that they liked it.
That seems a little irrational.
I didn't shove enough down your throat. Anyway. You know what I watched? I'll tell you what I watched. I watched Shame, finally. I hadn't seen it yet.
That's really Jason O'Brien life story.
That was his number one film of the year last year.
Yeah, I know. I wasn't shocked by that, but I was fascinated by that choice, though.
Yeah.
Not a movie I care for.
All right, Jamie, let's see the verdict from you.
I was moved by it. I definitely wouldn't have been my favorite last year, but I understood it. I felt the addiction and how it was kind of running his life.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people that have problems with it have a problem with it. The origins of the addiction are kind of ambiguous.
Mm-hmm. I just thought it verged on comedy sometimes. That I like the movie, but I don't love it. But I do like it. I like Fassbender so much. I'm willing to give him it's just a fascinating portrayal. But let me ask, and I might have said this on this show already. I've said it on several shows. When she's singing New York, New York, is she singing that? Is it meant to be that bad? That bad a rendition? Because it's like strangling the cat. I'm sorry, I couldn't stop laughing during that scene.
I don't know. I think it's just meant to be, you know, kind of a sad, run down kind of rendition of it.
Okay, but it comes across at some points like she's deliberately, she can't sing for all her. I mean, and she's such a great actress that she can do it that she can't sing, that make it convincing that she's a horrible singer.
I think it's awkward that she's up front and center. And that she's singing it in a very awkward way, but in a very open way,
mm-hmm.
like she's naked out there in front of everyone,
right?
And that's what she's doing, and I think that's what her brother can absolutely not do, and that's kind of what moves him about that performance,
mm-hmm.
and embarrasses him for her at the same time.
Right, right, yeah. That's a very good point.
I kind of love that scene. I love the two main actors in it, in that film. And there are other things I like about the movie, like some of the photography, some of the direction. But ultimately, my main complaint with the movie was just that I found it boring. I didn't feel that it went anywhere, really.
Yeah.
And I didn't really believe at the end that he was just, you know, saved from that. From that addiction or anything like that. I just think the movie kind of began and ended in about the same place. And I just, you know, it wasn't a movie for me.
Yeah. Well,
I didn't love Hunger, though. Hunger was great.
I didn't mind that that there wasn't a great epiphany that brought along a lot of change.
I don't see how there could be a great epiphany. That's what I like. In the truly great movies like this, I mean, the first movie I think of is Bad Lieutenant when I think of this movie. That's the first.
Yeah, and Bad Lieutenant's actually a better movie about addiction.
Yeah.
But I agree. I think this one's a pretty good one, too.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating, it's a fascinating film. I mean, and it's just, he has such screen presence, you're willing to watch him in almost anything, really. I mean, he's just got this incredible demeanor about him, and it's just, but
he's just very relaxed, very natural, not stiff at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I mean, it's a fascinating movie. It's not a great movie, but it's a fascinating movie.
I think it takes some chances.
It does.
And I think it got through what, for me, and people that hate it and people that like it are kind of separated by, well, it's not really an addiction, or the part that like it say, well, yeah, I can see that completely running his life. And I saw it as an addiction. Now I think that's what makes it different from Last Tango, because people always compare it to Last Tango. And it's not worthy of that. Certainly not.
It's
because
not
Last
the same
Tango
kind
is one of
my
movie. Favorites.
It's not the same. If they're
it's,
what,
it,
because
it,
of the
it,
sex,
it,
is that why? Is this because of the sex?
Last Tango isn't about addiction at all.
No, that's what I mean. That's why I said
right.
Bad Lieutenant. I thought Bad Lieutenant was really its closest.
Yeah.
Cousin, really, relative in that sense. Not Last Tango. While I was watching it, and I was just like, no, I wasn't thinking Last Tango at all.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting movie. Then I have been rewatching The Godfathers. I got the Blu-ray set up really late, getting the Blu-ray stuff for The Godfather.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm watching the stuff specific to the
mm-hmm.
Blu-ray, and then I was playing through Part 2, the commentary on 2. What can you say? Just
they
amazing.
Just don't make them like that anymore. I mean,
they never made them. I mean, that's a one-off band. The
yeah.
Godfather is like.
Yeah, I mean,
Fans
they just
alone.
Don't, you know, like, as we speak, Lawrence of Arabia is on right now, and he's like, Lawrence of Arabia, the Godfather. I mean, there's a reason why these movies still hold up well today, but they just don't make them like, I mean, I don't mean to sound like an old fogey, but they really just don't make them like
yeah.
that. Even the really, truly great films you see today don't hold a candle to these old-time, I don't know if the movies that we like so much in the last 10 years will, in 30 years, hold up that well.
No,
I don't think so. I don't think. I mean, you know, every year has really great movies in them. So, you know, I think we'll have movies that hold up. But we'll always be talking about The Godfather and Lawrence of Arabia,
yeah,
but particularly
yeah,
about the.
So.
Particularly about The Godfather. The Godfather is so extraordinary. Also, just like Gone with the Wind is extraordinary. I mean, they're long movies, but, boy, they speed by like they're 10 minutes.
Oh, I know. Well, all of them speed by. It's an amazing thing. You're never bored.
Yeah.
You're never looking at your watch. Never.
Yeah. Even if you've seen it, you know, 10, 15 times or whatever, you know, it's amazing how wrapped that The Godfather movies keep you.
Oh, I know.
Well, and, you know, that phrase, that William Goldman phrase, like nobody knows anything or whatever that is. Coppola obviously knew how to put together The Godfather and The Godfather 2.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because all of his instincts were dead on. So that line could kind of be rephrased in terms of Godfather saga to say that, you know, studio executives don't know anything.
Well, I think that's what he meant. I think that was the original intention.
Yeah, I do too.
Because, man, they sure didn't.
God, no, surely all their instincts were dead wrong. I mean...
Yeah, they did everything they could to try and derail it. So, you know, they're certainly not
even
one
Mario
of the reasons
Puzo.
It was a success.
Mario
yeah.
Puzo's
mm-hmm.
original script, which was, at the time, just takes place in contemporary times. You know, he updated it for, like, the late 60s.
Because they wanted him to.
Yeah, it was awful. It was just awful. Supposed
the studio
to.
Said, make it present day
yeah,
so
I mean,
for budgetary reasons.
Yeah, it's just, and it wasn't going to work. I mean, everything that Coppola did, every decision was right on. I mean, there's no doubt about that.
Yeah, and it was, I guess it's just Coppola as a hungry artist, you know, somebody with... These legendary, something legendary to prove, you know, it's just full of vigor. And,
yeah.
you know, he kind of got quite a launch on Apocalypse Now, even though he had to sell a lot. I mean, he sell his home and put his home up for, I don't know, mortgage his home or whatever, to finish that movie. But that's Apocalypse Now was a no-holds-barred movie. I don't see a lot of studio interference in the creative decisions in that movie necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked.
Yeah. Oh yeah. It did.
But
well,
then One from the Heart.
Yes.
What do we think of One from
exactly.
the Heart?
It's intermittently successful, I think. And
we're still
talking
about it. I think that's
yeah.
a good sign. I mean, it's not at the time of its release, it was not well received, but it is something that it has gotten, like, in a way, in a weird, similar to Heaven's Gate, that has been respect. It has gained stature and respect over the decades.
I remember Richardson saying that that his favorite, one of his favorite filmmakers, is Coppola, and said that seeing One from the Heart changed the way he looked at shooting movies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's definitely an innovative movie.
Right.
If it's not entirely successful, at least it's reaching. And that's what I always saw Coppola doing in those years of his career. I mean, he was always reaching, always experimenting, always
right.
seeing how far he could go.
No, you're right, absolutely.
And that's where great art comes from. That's where great disaster comes from, too. But great art comes from that, too.
Well, you got to risk. You got to do something new. I mean, to really be... That's what made a lot of that's why we talk about a lot of these movies from the 70s. All these guys took risks. Not many people take risks now. We see that time and time again. So, yeah.
So another figure from that period of filmmaking is Scorsese, and quite a few people think of Scorsese as a sellout.
How so?
Well, that he's gone big studio, he's gone Hollywood, he's softened.
I feel that way.
I don't feel that way at all. I think I think if that is selling out, then count me in. I'll sell out too.
Well, I mean,
if I could make a film like Gangs in New York, or The Departed, or if that's selling out, count me in.
Scorsese's interesting because with his narrative movies, I feel that you know, he's gone too much for the $100 million you know, budgets and so forth and so on, and I think that hamstrings his creativity in some ways. I like the Scorsese that was working on very limited budgets, and I mean, even Age of Innocence didn't cost $100 million. I don't know what it did cost, but it didn't. It wasn't a huge number like that. But you know, Scorsese is interesting too because he seems to be running two careers concurrently with one another. There's the career that's in documentary narrative filmmaking, and then there's the one that's in documentary filmmaking. And I still love almost all of his documentary work. I don't think I've seen one documentary that he's directed that I went, ugh.
Let me ask you a question. Should he reject the budget? Should he say, I don't need this? I don't need to do this?
No. I would say, you know, if I were him, you know, to remain fresh, I would at least do the occasional, you know, $10 million, $20 million.
You know, that's interesting with Scorsese too, because he has done that before in his career. I mean, that was the whole intention of After Hours, which
mm-hmm.
was to go,
right.
which was to go back and do something really guerrilla style, mm-hmm. and on
yeah.
the fly, because he felt like he needed a refreshment. But I don't know that he has softened. I think The Aviator is one of his most interesting character studies,
mm-hmm.
and I don't know that it's necessarily a safe bet, like a 3-hour epic about the guy that invented the airplane, being as successful as that movie was, even with Leo in the lead. I mean, it wasn't necessarily 100% safe, and that was a $100 million-plus movie to make.
Yeah, I got to be honest, he's not a safe filmmaker at all. I mean, he's Hal Hartley 10, 12 years ago in an interview said, you don't want to be at my age where you're trying to scrounge up money, you're still making independent films. You want to make studio films. That's why we're doing this, we want the money. We want as much money as we can to make our films. You don't want to be doing what I'm doing at my age. He's using Kickstarter. That's all fine and dandy when you're first starting out, but you don't want to do that. I applaud Scorsese maybe The Departed, but Gangs of New York is not a safe film. It's not a mellow film by any stretch of the imagination. It is not a commercial film either.
It's also not a very good movie.
No, I think it's actually a magnificent. I think it's his tribute to Sergio Leone.
I think it's a great movie.
It's just beautiful.
I'd be interested in knowing if he feels that movie's compromised at all, though. because for him to have spent, I mean, he dreamt of that movie for a long time,
right.
Had such a hard time getting it made, even as he was making it, there was all the tension between he and Weinstein, and I'm wondering if he feels like what he got on the screen was what he absolutely wanted all those years.
Right.
Because something does feel just a bit off with it, but it's still, I mean, its ambition and its performances and some of the sequences, I mean, it's vintage Scorsese, a lot of it.
Mm-hmm.
But The Departed, I think he knew that he was safe. He was, but that was okay with him. He said, okay, this is my ground.
Yeah.
I'm the guy that does this better than anybody, and this is what I'm going to do this time. I'm going to make my B picture, you know?
Yeah, he did it. He made a great, great, great B movie. I mean,
but then he made Kundun, you know, and he was asked by Ovitz, what's your dream project? He said, Last Temptation. They said, okay, let's do Last Temptation. Then he was asked by, again, what's your dream project? And he said, Gangs of New York. So, all right, let's finally do that. And so he doesn't shy away from making personal projects. And I think whatever he does make, by and large, whether studio or not, he makes it personal.
Yes.
I mean, Cape Fear is a prime example.
Yeah.
Cape Fear is as commercial and mainstream thriller, as you'll see, but it contains stuff that's entirely personal to Scorsese.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it kind of imbues it with these themes of morality and biblical vengeance and all, especially if you look at De Niro's character as not a physical being. I mean, the movie takes a whole different kind of metaphorical tone.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think he's... even if these other movies, Silence and The Snowman... if they ever see the light of day, I mean, you know, he's not a. I mean, he. I don't think he's. I don't think he compromises. I don't think he plays it safe. He does. I mean, look at something like Bringing Out the Dead. That's not a commercial film. I mean, it's got a big cast and everything, but that's a very. I think that is a very personal film. You could say that's a sequel, not only to Taxi Driver, but also After Hours in many ways.
I still feel like, you know, I think the main thing, I don't really feel like he's softened in the projects that he's chosen, but I don't really mind him having the budgets. What I do mind is really specifically the need, given that the budgets are so high, the need to cast DiCaprio almost exclusively as his lead in the past decade. In order to get butts in the seats, DiCaprio can be good, but for me, DiCaprio still seems like a kid. And I mean, even though he's in his mid-30s now or whatever, he still feels like a kid. I mean, and I find it difficult to believe him in a lot of the roles that he's chosen in the past few years.
Agree with that. With the exception of J. Edgar, I haven't seen him really in a bad film. At least to me, I have. J. Edgar was the one I thought he was miscast for.
I thought he was miscast in Gangs of New York. I thought for the same thing with Cameron Diaz in it. I mean, the best thing about Gangs of New York is Daniel Day-Lewis, and that's the reason to watch the movie and the art direction. DiCaprio just, I mean, even in The Aviator, which I've watched again, and I like it a little bit more than I did the first time, but I still feel like DiCaprio doesn't quite rise to, there could have been better choices out there. There are better choices out there. I feel like Scorsese has limited his choices by the size of his budgets, and that's my main complaint with Scorsese now. I still think I'll go see everything that he does, but
I think that DiCaprio's first real adult performance was The Aviator. I think he's brilliant in it.
He's very good in it.
Gangs of New York, I mean, the hot-headed youthfulness of him,
mm-hmm.
Gangs of New York actually works in service of that character.
And Catch Me If You Can comes out the same time. He's very good in that. I thought it was this 1-2 punch from him of great, two great performances in 2002.
But you're right. I mean, he is working with DiCaprio too much. But I mean, that's his MO. I mean, DiCaprio is his new De Niro.
Yeah, I have no problem with that.
Yeah.
No problem whatsoever.
I can't compare the 2000s DiCaprio with the 1970s and 80s De Niro. There's just no comparison.
I mean, I see your point in terms of quality, but I'm talking about quantity. I mean, he worked with De Niro for like 8 times, and he's working with DiCaprio the same amount of times.
Four times with DiCaprio?
Yeah, and then about to be a fifth, I guess, or later this year.
Yeah.
So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, obviously they've worked together, you know, obviously that's that connection, but comparing the collaborations between Scorsese and De Niro and the collaborations between Scorsese and DiCaprio,
it's an unfair comparison, because I have to, first of all, we have to see how, you know, these films are at best a decade old. Let's come back 10, 20 years and see how these later Scorsese films hold up. Right now, they hold up, but let's see in 20 years, does Gangs of New York hold up? The Aviator hold up? I mean, like Goodfellas and Taxi Driver and Mean Streets hold up very well. I mean, there's no denying that.
Well, nobody I know is saying that Gangs of New York and The Aviator are even in the same league as Taxi Driver and Raging Bull.
Raging Bull, yeah. I mean, they're all great films.
Just not.
I mean,
in 1980, nobody said that about Heaven's Gate in relation to Deer Hunter. But now they're saying Heaven's Gate is Shimito's masterpiece, a lot of people.
Yeah, I mean, it will depend. I mean, I wouldn't put them in that category, you know, those films yet in those categories, but I do think they're good films. Now, do I think they're in the same league as Goodfellas or even a Casino, for that matter? No, but let me come back
God,
to the live in 20 years, and I'll tell you.
God, I love Casino. But there's also this about Scorsese has always played with form.
Mm-hmm.
He's always played with, and a lot of times, popular Hollywood movie form.
Mm-hmm.
And so you see that in Hugo. You see that in, I mean, all of his stuff.
Yeah. I mean,
or so much of his stuff. So he'll take, like, a popular form, and he'll give his own twist on it, kind of like what Tarantino does.
Yeah.
Now, but...
But it's a fascinating... I think Scorsese is one of these directors who has... of that generation of filmmakers who hasn't lost his touch at all.
Yeah, he certainly hasn't lost his enthusiasm. And I think enthusiasm is the first thing to go for a lot of people, and
yeah.
You start to see that in their work.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is true.
Yeah.
I still feel a lot of
passion in Scorsese's film.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
I think that's what... that's what I require most of all from somebody like Scorsese, even if the subject matter doesn't interest me. And very rarely do the projects Scorsese picks, do they interest me just as a subject.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of the passion and the adrenaline and the excitement of making a movie that I feel come off the screen from a
right.
Scorsese film. That's what gets me.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
Okay. What are some other 70s titans and where they are now?
Well, as you mentioned one earlier, William Friedkin, and he's doing an opera right now. What about De Palma? Now, De Palma's working on this new movie.
Passion, yes.
Mm-hmm. And where would you say he is right now? He's in an interesting place.
Still disrespected.
He'll always be disrespected. But he made a really... really good movie, or at least one of his, I think Femme Fatale was like really one of his better movies of late in the last 10
years. I
agree. And is it like, you know, because he had, you know, there's an argument to say that he lost his touch at times, but I really think Femme Fatale is just really like this huge surprise. Just like, wow, he still has this in him. And that was fascinating to watch.
I hope Passion can be that too.
I hope so.
I mean, he's somebody
there
that
in the Black Dahlia in parts, but not as a whole. But it's there in parts.
That was a bad movie, though. Black
it is
Dahlia.
A bad movie, but it's there. It is that passion is there in, at times. You know,
there are a couple. There are a couple of sequences I feel like he came alive in during that movie, where he was having a good time.
He was definitely having a good time. Yeah.
But I think out of all of them. Actually, I think out of all of them, he's the one with the most fire still in his belly. He's the one that's not afraid to mix it up still, because if you think about De Palma, the countercultural kind of rebel with the political undertones, yeah, and everything he did, it's still there in something like Redacted. Even if you think that's an awful film, which I don't think it's a successful movie necessarily.
No, but it's there though. The passion, as you say, is still there.
It's still incendiary.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know any one of those late 60s, 70s filmmakers that are still doing that necessarily.
Well, there's Polanski. He's still, I think, trying to...
I don't mean in personal life. I mean in actual films.
No, I mean, like, even in something like Carnage or The Ghost Rider, I think he's still trying to stir it up.
Well, I think The Ghost Rider is one of his most successful films in the latter part of his career.
I love Ghost Rider.
The Ghost Rider is excellent. He's another one who at times it looks like had lost interest, or the films weren't as interesting, but then he does something like The Pianist, and that really brings him back into full form, and it's a brilliant movie. And then you have something like The Ghost Rider, which is really good, and I mean, he's a fascinating filmmaker.
Even his adaptation of Oliver Twist was pretty good. I mean, you know,
mm-hmm.
I wasn't a big fan of Carnage, and I actually think it might be one of his weakest movies that he's ever made. But it had some very, very interesting ideas to impart, and it did have good acting in it and so forth.
It was tailor-made for Polanski because it had that kind of minute observation of behavior in a very
right.
confined, suffocating setting.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what he excels at.
It's interesting, though. A lot of the 70s titans, you know, of course, have passed away, like, you know, Robert Altman and Bob Fosse and Sidney Lumet, of course.
Altman never lost it. I mean, he always made truly great films, and then he made mediocre films. He kind of switched back and forth throughout his career, and his latter part of his career is no different. But
he made what he wanted to make.
Yeah, he never lost that maverick kind of spirit.
Mm-hmm. What about Alan Rudolph?
Alan Rudolph has been strangely quiet, like, over the past decade or so. I mean, I haven't seen a new Alan Rudolph movie in ages, it feels like. What was the last thing he did?
Well, he did something after, but I love The Secret Lives of Dentists. I thought that was a really good movie. Before that, it was Trixie, and that was disappointing, but... But there is a movie after Lives of Dennis. I don't know what it is. There is one after that. Choose Me, Welcome to L.A. I mean, a lot of great, great Trouble in Mind. A lot of truly great films. And
most of his stuff was 80s stuff, though. His first movie was Remember My Name, right? Was that what it was called? That was in 78 or 77, you know.
But it's important to bring him up because it's important to bring. You can't really talk. You really do have to sort of bring him up because he is a very important part and offspring of the 70s. Regardless, I mean, when he made those films, but who else? I mean, is obviously you have Spielberg and Lucas, and that's but they're
Bacala is gone, Ashby is gone, Uwe Grossbard. You know, Peter Bogdanovich doesn't make movies anymore. William Friedkin, you know, is very spotty in movies.
Peter Bogdanovich, even though Texasville was a dud, should he just go ahead and buy the rights to Larry McMurtry's Dwayne's Depressed, get Jeff Bridges, and should he just complete this fucking trilogy cinematically?
I would. If I were him, I'd just go ahead and do it because it should be done. I kind of like Texasville.
It should be done. It's out there. It's written. It was written like a decade ago. They might as well just do it. I mean,
yeah, why not?
I mean, so everyone. I mean, you know, Civil Shepherd's alive. Jeff Bridges. Let's just get it done with.
Almost the whole cast is still alive. You know, I mean, everybody who needs to be.
Yeah. So. Let's just do it.
Who are the greatest directors of all time? Well,
oh God, we're not doing another list, are we?
Is it time for the list? Let's just go ahead and say that Christopher Nolan and David Fincher are going to be 1 and 2.
Okay. Here is, according to Movie Maker magazine.
Oh, God. Okay.
Not necessarily greatest, but the most influential directors of all time.
Didn't we do this list a couple weeks ago or months ago? Or
no.
Maybe not.
No. Not this one.
Not this
Sorry.
One.
Sorry, dude. No getting out of it.
Oh, God. Yeah, well, so much for that. All right.
Can I have my mother write me a sick note?
Yeah, really?
Can I get out of this somehow? So Movie Maker magazine, let's run through their 20 most influential directors of all time, and then we'll get out of here. See what conversation it sparks. Number 20, Buster Keaton.
I can't have a problem with that. I mean, come
would
on.
You put
sure.
Buster Keaton over or under Charlie Chaplin?
Mm.
Well, I like Buster Keaton a little bit more for laughs, but for film, it would be Chaplin over Keaton.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Buster Keaton owes me money, so I mean, yeah, I'd have to, you know, fuck him. I know, I don't. Yeah, I mean, no, Chaplin for sure. I mean,
number 19, Francois Truffaut.
I have to see who comes. I mean, he's wow. I mean, just the Day for Night alone and the 400. I mean, come on.
400 blow. Yeah.
400 blowjobs. I mean, but.
Number 18, Howard Hawks.
Hawks, I mean, I guess Hawks was influential, but it's hard to feel his influence these days.
I mean, you see it in the 70s directors. You see it, obviously, in Coppola and even De Palma with Scarface. You can't not be influenced by Howard Hawks and remake Scarface. But you can't make also – but you don't see it – unfortunately, where you don't see it is you don't see – we don't have many comedy of manners anymore, so we
uh-huh,
don't really
uh-huh.
– we unfortunately don't see as that witty – the witty dialogue that he had in his films.
Yeah, it's been replaced by physical comedy and
yeah.
like pratfalls and gross outs, yeah.
More – yeah.
Yeah.
Number 17, Coppola.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't argue with these. I just have to see who's coming up on the list.
16, Jean Renoir.
I've always been sort of blah on Jean Renoir. I know that's
Jean Renoir.
Well,
Renoir.
I mean,
I
can't
land
on him. I mean, what he? I mean, if I'm not mistaken, Beauty and the Beast, right?
What?
Yeah, wasn't
no. That's
make...
Dean Cocteau. I'm sorry.
That's,
yeah,
that's
Cocteau.
I'm sorry. You know, I'm. Well, wait.
So
I'm sorry.
We're talking
sorry about
rules
that.
That was the guy that was an oceanographer.
Oh, Rules of the Game. You don't think Rules of the Game?
I find Rules of the Game incredibly dull. I have tried to get through it 3 times, and I mean, I've gotten through it 3 times, but it just never engages me. I just don't get what everybody loves about
oh,
that film.
Well, I mean, it's the end of the way of life. I mean,
if you talk about influential, though, I mean, you'll see a lot of the big filmmakers, the ones that influence today's filmmakers, citing Rules of the Game
movie.
As one of the best.
I mean, it's just, oh my God. It's very sad. That's, I mean, really, like a tearjerker. I'm sorry. I mean,
Grand Illusion is good, but
Illusion's awesome. I mean, Grand Illusion is just magnificent, but, oh, God, both of them. I mean, that was a great double bill when we saw that a long time ago.
Outside of those two movies, name another Jean Renoir movie without going to the internet.
Mike Colvin.
One of Scorsese's
Mike Colvin is
favorite movies. Mike Colvin.
Yeah. I just made that up, dude.
Mike Colvin. Jean Renoir is Mike Colvin.
All right, is Marcel Carney on this list by any chance?
Not on this
list. Well, let him get through it.
Number 15, Billy Wilder.
Yeah, he has to be.
Yes, absolutely.
Definitely has to be on this fucking list. I mean, come on.
Really, like a jack of all trades.
Yeah.
Really, you know, of all genres. 14, Cassavetes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, just the whole indie movement is because of him, really. So,
number 13, Ingmar Bergman.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely. No question about it. Although nobody, absolutely nobody, is attempting to do anything like what he tried to do, because you can't even really make any kind of, you can't do what Woody Allen did with, you know, Interiors without getting crap from the critical community that you're ripping off Bergman. So it's like I don't see anybody actually doing what he tried to do.
Yeah, it's interesting. He died. He died like a day before Antonioni.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. He also died on the same day as Tom Snyder.
Oh man, tomorrow, man, coast to coast.
I used to love Tom Snyder.
Oh, he was great. I love Dan Aykroyd's impersonation of him.
Yeah.
Yeah, almost a little bit more than that, the actual Tom Snyder.
You don't have many like him anymore. You don't have anybody.
I actually watched some Tom Snyder clips last night on YouTube, because they have his whole uninterrupted interview with Charles Manson. It's a really interesting dynamic. Tom Snyder is sitting in a cell with Charles Manson. Number 12.
That's one of the most famous interviews, you know.
Yeah, it is. But he also talked to people. I mean, you saw him as kind of a straight-laced guy, but he sat down with, you know, tons of people, like Sex
Pistols.
Yeah.
That would be his second most famous interview. He does a really good interview. You can see this online with Alfred Hitchcock.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he does. That is a good one. Number 12, Akira Kurosawa.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the action movie.
The action movie
was
everything to him. And just any, I mean.
And how many times have we seen Rashomon remade in various forms?
Yeah. Countless times. But, I mean, not just that. I mean, just, I mean, he made, towards the very end, you know, all these great epics. And he, I mean, you see his work in a lot of, you know, what does it say that young Japanese filmmakers are remaking his films? There was a remake of The Seven Samurai. There's obviously Takashi Miike's 13 Assassins, which owes a lot to The Seven Samurai as well. And it's just, his influence is still felt. I mean, it's felt in Tarantino. It's felt everywhere. I mean, in Scorsese, for that matter, and Coppola,
yeah,
for that matter. I mean, it's always going to be felt. And they all adored him.
Well, number 11 on this list is Martin Scorsese.
Yeah.
Number 11.
But I got to
Now
I got to see who they're putting up in front of these guys, though.
Number 10 is Steven Spielberg.
J.J. Abrams loves him.
No question about this.
Number 9 is Federico Fellini.
Yeah,
awesome filmmaker, but where do we see his influence? That's what I got to ask. I mean, I love him. I mean, I love all these guys, but where would Fellini's influence be?
I guess we see his influence in the other filmmakers that are further down on this list.
Okay, that's what we got to see. I mean,
certainly you have to say that that Fellini influenced people like Fosse. And even Woody Allen.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. Woody Allen, definitely. Of all directors, you would see, obviously, Bergman and Fellini, and Wilder, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
I don't know where I would see.
These days, it's not, you know, Fellini's ghost isn't raised
there
up
is
in
one.
Too.
You know who you see Fellini in? In all seriousness, is Pedro.
Oh, you're right.
You see him in Volver, you see it in Broken Embraces, you see it in Talk to Me. You actually do see a lot of Fellini in him. As far as the contemporary American filmmakers, though, I don't see a lot of Fellini, though.
Yeah.
Number 8, Charlie Chaplin.
Yes, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Number 7, Eisenstein.
I mean, he revolutionized, you know, editing and just how to make a movie, of course.
See, this isn't an easy list like Chris Nolan and
You know, it's interesting you bring that up, Eisenstein, because I've never seen it, but the Russians just recently remade Alexander Nevsky. And I'd be curious to see that, because I've watched Alexander Nevsky countless times. But you see, in a movie like Mongol that came out a couple of years ago, you do see Alexander Nevsky's influence. You know what other movie you see Alexander Nevsky was a huge influence is John Milius' Conan the Barbarian, owes so much to Alexander Nevsky in the battle scene, I think. So.
Well, they do say with Eisenstein, it is all in the editing.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, mostly with the Odessa Steppe sequence, obviously, which is one of the most famous pieces of film.
Right.
Their number six is Stanley Kubrick.
Yep, obviously. You know, obviously. Although, again, you know, no one can replicate what he does, you know, a lot of this influence is that's reflected on this list is really just influence in that they made movies that influenced other people to make their own movies.
Yeah.
And so, yeah. I mean, but they haven't. A lot of these directors haven't been, you know, stolen from a whole lot. I don't think because.
But they cite something like. His work could be horrifying one moment and kind of bitingly funny the next.
Right. Well,
and it is kind of like a point of view that he had where you didn't know quite how to feel moment to moment about what you were seeing. It wasn't easy.
Well, wouldn't you say then in something like Funny Games that Michael Haneke has that influence with something like Tarantino? Also has an influence.
It's hard to tell who Tarantino is not influenced by.
That's a very good question. And where you kind of think he is influenced, it's you go back and you look at the films he likes, and you're like, wow, he really wasn't influenced by.
And you see him put all of his influences into a blender, really.
Yeah, he really does. He does. But you know who else is influenced by Kubrick? And as recent as, and very recently, is Brian De Palma in Redacted. There's a lot of things that remind me in Redacted from Paths of Glory. A lot of the way the shots are framed and everything, and it was very reminiscent of Paths of Glory. So even though he's... You
and
know,
the music comes from Barry Lyndon.
Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. So I think that's an interesting influence that a lot of people, when they're... You know, I'm not crazy about Redacted either, but I think there's still a lot to talk about with it. There's definitely the influence of where he was influenced, what he is taken. I mean, let's look at something like Coppola. He was, for The Godfather 3, there are things taken from The Man Who Knew Too Much and The Conformist. There are things. So I think it's very interesting when we talk about these master filmmakers influenced by even greater masters. So
John Ford is number five.
Yeah, he has to be on there. I mean, come on. The Searchers, Alone. The Door Shot, Alone.
The Long Shot, the sweeping epics.
Yeah, I mean, it's just... Yeah.
It's funny, I saw on the site In Contention, they were... or maybe it was Awards Daily, Sasha Stone's site. Ryan Adams on there.
You're fading in and out, dude.
Ryan Adams just recently put up his... 50 greatest movies of the 50s, and he left The Searchers off of it because he admitted that he could not put it in there because the racism in it made him feel weird. And he said he knew that it was an important movie, and he knew that the shot at the end was great and everything, but it was just he said I'm not really into Westerns until the racism gets cut out of them, you know, in the 60s or so, until they become revisionist Westerns. And that's the way I think a lot of people think about Westerns now. They just can't go back and watch those old Westerns because they feel dirty after they watch them, you know, which I think is unfortunate, you know. But, I, you know, just wanted to put that throw that comment. By the way, I wanted to mention three directors that are really influenced by Kubrick. I was waiting for a moment to get in there. Mark Romanek, who did 1 Hour Photo and Never Let Me Go, feels very Kubrickian to me. Also, Keith Gordon, who's, you know, we've had on the show before.
Yeah.
His movies from the 90s are obviously Kubrick-influenced.
Mother Night.
Mother Night and Chocolate War and particularly Midnight Clear.
Yeah, Midnight Clear, yeah, definitely.
And then Nicholas Winding Refn, I think is how you say his last name. I still don't know how to really say
yeah.
it, but... with things like with Bronson in particular,
yeah.
feels very Kubrickian.
I was thinking about that earlier.
So Kubrick does have his influence.
Oh, yeah.
Jean-Luc Godard is number four.
Tarantino, with obviously, but, his influence is all over the place.
Yeah, although nobody tries to do what he does, so...
They all do. I mean, they don't try, they do it. I mean, he kind of instituted the jump cut. I mean, that's done in tons of movies.
But I mean, they're not putting, titles up in between scenes and stuff like that.
Well, they're not all as wacky as he is, but...
Honestly, most people couldn't tell you more than three Godard movies.
But the whole kind of free, experimental spirit of filmmaking, he discovered a lot of innovations in that are followed today. Whether they know it or not.
Yeah. Yeah, okay.
Number three is Orson Welles.
Interesting. That's good. Citizen King. Just as the films he directed, or...
Yeah, as a director, yeah.
Okay, yeah, because even the ones he just acted in are so good, too. But, obviously Touch of Evil and obviously Citizen Kane. But there are others, too. There are others. Great. I wish Criterion would just come out with a Magnificent Ambersons kind of that. I really do.
His Othello and Macbeth are incredible. He was just an incredible filmmaker. And what was amazing about his career was that he was able to do it while being a pariah in Hollywood and while doing so many other projects, too, on top of things, on top of all that,
Right.
Leading such a rich life, on top of making movies he's just an icon.
He's an icon, but I don't know that he'd agree with you that he led a rich life, fewer life today.
Have you ever read this is Orson Welles' his interview with Peter Bogdanovich? That guy was everywhere. He knew everybody. He knew everybody from Picasso to...
I understand that. What I'm saying is this is a man whose career and life peaked at the age of 25. This is a man that years later said that I probably shouldn't have even gotten into film. It's just pure misery. So this is a man who his life was battling to get, pennies for his little pet projects and selling himself out, and he knew it.
Yeah, I know. I'm not saying that it was the happiest of lives, but it was a rich life. He traveled all around the world. He dabbled in every single kind of art there was. He knew all the great people. And that's a rich life.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Okay.
Yeah.
Number two is D.W. Griffith.
Yeah,
can't argue with that.
Yeah, I can't argue with that. I'm not even gonna try to argue with that.
What is Hitchcock not on this list? Okay.
Number one is Alfred Hitchcock.
All right.
Yeah, I can't argue with any of these. This is actually a very insightful list. I really can't disagree with any of this.
Okay, good. So if you guys feel one way or another about who should be included on this top 20, just write us at moviegeeksunited.com. What's our email? MovieGeeksUnited@yahoo.com.
Why isn't Tyler Perry on this? No,
I don't know. That's a good question. Right outside the top 20 are Fritz Lang, John Huston, Woody Allen, Brunel, Lubitsch. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, those are all awesome choices, too.
Okay.
They are.
Let's close out the show. I don't know when we'll be back. Maybe never.
Oh, don't say that. No, we'll probably be back. We'll probably be back next Sunday.
Maybe this is our final show.
Well, why don't you play the other music, Van the Dune music?
Anyway, I have no score. I was going to upload a movie song, actually, to close us out, but I don't have it. I didn't do that. I feel terrible about that. So I'll just close this out with this.
Thanking the Monkey. I think Thanking the Monkey is very bold.
David Russell on that list.
Okay. All right, guys. So we'll be back, not Wednesday. We might be back next Sunday.
Okay, awesome.
All right.
All right, thank you, everyone, for joining us, and have a great week.
All right, see you later.
Goodbye, everybody. Bye. Here's music from the movie Rampart, in case we haven't played it yet.